Okay, so it's Janet, and I want to welcome you to our live event. This is part of our cyber-based interdisciplinary science educators course. We are very excited. Our presenter today is polar researcher Elliot Freeman, and he's from Cornell. He's going to be talking about work that he's been conducting in the Arctic around terrestrial methane and microbiology. It's Wednesday, April 4th, 2012. And before we start the presentation with Elliot, there's a few things about this platform that we're using. It's called Blackboard Collaborate. The content should be changing in the center of the room for you, and you should see where on your screen a list of participants, and you should also have access to a chat room and be able to type in there and post questions or relay information back and forth to all of us that are participating today. If at any time you have a question, you can type it in there. Since there are a lot of us that are on live today, you can also just click the little hand icon on the list of participants, and that lets us know you have a question. We'll go to you live. And I don't think anybody's calling from a phone, so that's all right. And again, this is being archived, and we'll send out the archive link to everybody as well as post it on the website. So real quickly, we will do some quick participant introductions, just so you recognize my voice, Janet Warburton. I'm project manager at Polar Trek, working here at Arcus in Fairbanks, Alaska.
And my name is on the Polar Trek program, again, here in Fairbanks.
And we have a couple of people that are just joining us, but we'll go to Julia. Can you introduce yourself?
I'm Julia. I work for Elk Meadow School teaching high school science. We are a correspondence school, distance learning for homeschool kids. We have students all over, actually all over the world. I live in the Adirondack Mountains of New York State.
And Julia, can you tell us a little bit about why you're interested in polar science and maybe taking this class, why it's of interest to you?
Yeah, I just find I need to immerse myself more in what's really going on, because kind of to liven up my teaching, and also I love being in the polar regions, and I just would love to spend more time there, and it's just really exciting to learn the new stuff.
Okay, excellent. Welcome. I don't know if Noah, you can hear me or not, but Noah, talk.
I think it's working, is it? I'm with this Learn the Schools program located in Colorado, and it's an outreach program that teaches us the renewable energy as a solution to climate change, but I'm really interested in methane as a climate change factor.
Great. All right. Thank you, Noah, and welcome. And Alex, I don't know if you have a mic. I see you typing away. Alex does not have access to a mic, so she'll introduce herself through the chat feature. Okay, so real quickly, I think everybody, maybe the only person that's online today that might not know what Polar Trek is, but just for people that might be listening to this archive as well, we are hosting the Sea Ice class in this event through the Polar Trek program that stands for Teachers and Researchers Exploring and Collaborating, and we pair teachers with researchers and place them in the polar regions for experiences. This is a national science-funded project and through the Office of Polar Programs, and we have funding until the year 2014. And the Sea Ice class itself is a way to connect teachers with researchers and polar researchers so that you get some more content knowledge about what is happening in the polar regions, even if you can't go there on these research expeditions. So, with that, Elliot, I'm going to turn it over to you, And I will be quiet on this end, and I'll let you introduce yourself and navigate the slides. So, welcome. We don't hear you, Elliot.
There, I forgot about the talk button.
So, there you go.
There we go. So, my name is Elliot. I'm a PhD candidate at Cornell University. I'm in the Department of Biological and Environmental Engineering. And you can feel free to interrupt at any time if you have questions. But basically, what we're going to talk about today is some methane and microbiology in the polar regions and some of the work that we're doing up there. So a little background about myself. I did an undergraduate degree in environmental engineering from Lehigh University, which is in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And then I came up here to Cornell directly after that. And I've been here for just under 3 years now. And this coming summer will be our fourth season in the Arctic, working in Barrow, Alaska. So to give a little outline of what I'm going to talk about today, I'll go over an introduction to the North Slope. It's an area of Alaska that I find people are less familiar with than some of the other regions. I'll give you a little bit of an overview of the biosensor technology, which is a new application of an existing technology that we're using in the Arctic to study bacteria. And then I'll talk about the study that we're doing in Barrow, which specifically involves iron as a respiratory process, and talk more about that. And then finally, a little bit about some global climate models and methane emissions and how they tie into that Barrow study. And yes, we had a polar trek teacher on the project last year, and I got an email from Jim today, and he said he was going to try to join us as soon as he can. I know time zones are different, and I think he also coaches swimming, so it might be something with that. And we will have another teacher coming up with us this summer. So basically where we are, we're in Barrow, Alaska, and that's the red star up there. And the yellow star I put in for reference is where Healy is about, and that's where Elizabeth Webb, who gave the talk last week, that's where they're located. So there's quite a bit of distance between where the studies are happening. And you can see on the topographical map that we have the Brooks Range that separates Healy from Barrow. And we have above the Brooks Range is about 200 vertical miles of flat tundra. So Barrow is the northernmost city in the U.S. and one of the northernmost in the world. It's 320 miles north of the Arctic Circle. There are about 4,000 people that live there. And as I mentioned, it has this flat tundra that stretches about 200 miles to the south until you reach the northern extent of the Brooks Range. As a result of this, there's no wind barriers at all. And they experience freezing temperatures about 324 days out of the year. In addition, it's also a desert, so it's a tundra desert. They receive less than 5 inches of rain equivalent per year. This is rain and snow. And the other unique thing is that since we are above the Arctic Circle, it's dark from about November 18th to the end of January, and it's light 24 hours a day from the beginning of May until the beginning of August. So what we have is a pretty unique environment, and that's why we're interested in studying what's going on here, because it is such a unique environment. It's a large area, and also, as I'm sure we've all heard, the polar regions are more susceptible to climate change, and we've been seeing that so far. So a little bit about the North Slope topography. Like I said, it is fairly flat. It's a region above the Brooks Range. It's fairly sparsely populated. The places that you might have heard of are Barrow, Prudhoe Bay, where they drill for oil, and there are a couple other small towns, but other than that, there's not much. They have very, very little amount of rain, but because the ground is underlain with permafrost, there's really no place for this rain to go, and there's also very little vegetation and wildlife there that's using this range, so it kind of sticks around for a long time once it's there. And as a result, they have these lakes and rivers due to very slow evaporation, the freeze-thawing, and the underlying bedrock. And what you can see in the middle picture on the right there is just the satellite Google Maps view of the northern part of Alaska. If you get to the little green dot, that's where Barrow is on the top. But you can kind of see that there are a lot of lakes, and they're covering most of the surface. And in addition, what we have is something called polygonized tundra. And what this is if you start out with a flat, saturated soil, once it freezes, part of the part of that ground will get upheaved due to the freezing. And this happens over and over again, year by year, and as a result, you get a little bit of topography in this flat area. So you can see in the bottom picture, which is just an aerial view, you can see these squares and circles that are existing around this lake, and that's what we call the polygonized tundra. So the darker areas are depressions, and they're typically where the water table is above the soil surface, and the lighter areas are the areas that have been upheaved, so they're higher than the corresponding dark areas. And hopefully you can see in the top picture, you can kind of see that it's not totally flat, but there is some elevation change, even though it's only a few feet. So polar carbon, I put this in there, even though Elizabeth mentioned this last week, but the northern circumpolar permafrost soil holds about 16,000 picograms of carbon, and it's a very, very large pool of carbon. So it's up to 60% of the below ground carbon pool, and it's also been compared to a similar amount of carbon that would be in the atmosphere at any given time. And polar regions are more susceptible to climate change since they are most extreme regions of our planet. And what we really want to know is what happens to all this carbon as temperatures warm. And another thing that Elizabeth mentioned as well is we have a feed-forward or positive feedback process. And something that could happen here is if we warm the tundra a little bit, and as a result of it, we kind of activate this carbon and it gets released as greenhouse gases, that will then cause more warming, which will kind of circle back and cause more release of carbon. So that's a reason we have a big concern for this, and it's a popular term in climate change, this positive feedback process. So if we look at kind of a simplified view of what's happening in the Arctic with carbon, we have kind of the three main bodies, the atmosphere, the land, and the ocean. And within the land, we have the permafrost, and then we have the area, the section that thaws each year. And so we have basically carbon dioxide and methane traveling between the ocean and the atmosphere, and the land and the atmosphere. And then we have dissolved organic and inorganic carbon, and particular organic carbon that are traveling between the land and the ocean. And basically what we're interested in is this area in red. So the emissions between the land and the atmosphere. Did that go to the next slide there? And one thing we're particularly interested in, at least from my perspective, is methane. And methane emissions from the Arctic have increased 31% from 2003 to 2007. And it's a very small window to be looking at, but that's kind of concerning to us, and we want to know what's causing that and what controls the methane emissions from soils. And a little bit of background about methane. So the reason we're concerned about methane is because it has somewhere between 20 and 25 times the climate forcing potential of carbon dioxide. And it's formed via methanogenesis, which is an anaerobic process where organic matter is consumed by a class of microorganisms called methanogenic archaea, and they produce methane. And if you look down at the bottom, what you can see is a current phylogenetic tree of life. So you see bacteria, archaea, and the eukaryotes. If you look within the eukaryotes, you can find the animals, that would be us. And so these archaea that produce methane are not bacteria. They're a different class of microorganisms. They're an older class that evolved earlier. And a lot of these archaea that are still surviving are these methane-producing ones. You can see, I think, three of the seven ones there, the Methanosarcina, Methanobacterium, and the Methanococcus, are all archaea that produce methane. And a major place that this occurs in the environment is in natural wetlands and rice paddies. And that's the major kind of natural source of methane. Of course, we all, for those, I don't know if everybody hears about it, but in New York we hear a lot about methane from cows, from dairy farming and cattle grazing. But in terms of natural production, the main ecosystems in which this occurs is wetlands and rice paddies. And of these, somewhere between a quarter and a third of methane emissions from soil come from these high latitude wet soils. And so we'll kind of take a step back for a second and talk about different types of microbial respiration, just to give a little bit of background. And much in the way that we respire with oxygen and produce CO2, the microorganisms also respire. So we have kind of two different classes. First, we have the ones that happen in aerobic environments, and typically we're going to have the same type of aerobic respiration going on there, where oxygen is the electron acceptor for these bacteria. And that's the dominant process under these aerobic conditions because it's the most energetically favorable. On the other hand, if we have anaerobic conditions, we can have a couple different things happening. There's anaerobic respiration, in which the bacteria can use another electron acceptor other than oxygen in a similar process. It's a little less energetically favorable for them, but they can use things like nitrate, manganese, iron, or sulfate. Another class would be these methanogenic archaea, and that's a different species, and different things are happening. And finally, we have fermentation, which is another method. It's not as energetically favorable as aerobic respiration, which is the most favorable, but it's another thing that can happen in anaerobic environments. And what we know is that there are a wide variety of factors that influence which of these processes may dominate if we have anaerobic conditions. So environmental variables such as pH or moisture, things like that, are going to control what microorganisms are the most dominant species. And finally, to bring it first full circle back to what we're studying, we have these Arctic wetlands. And specifically, we look at different types of lake basins that are formed as a result of the climate and freeze-thawing process. So I mentioned that these lakes exist, and they are covering most of the surface, and they are there for a long time because there's no place for the water to go. But when they do drain, they then go through a cycle of ages, young, medium, old, and ancient, that covers somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 or more years until they come back to being a lake again, and then the whole process starts over again. And you can see some pictures of what we have going on in the different basins, but basically the young basin will be a kind of depressed, uniform basin that might be a few feet below the surrounding area. And then as this freeze-thaw process occurs, and polygonized tundra starts to form, you get into this medium age basins where you can see we have some areas that have risen above others and some that are depressed. And finally, as this progresses through the old and the ancient, we can see this in the ancient is we always have smaller lakes that are occurring within this larger lake basin. So these are the soil in these wetlands is anaerobic because the water table is so high. So you can see, at least in the young picture, that the water is above the ground surface. So basically all of this is going to be anaerobic, and there's lots of carbon. And since there's such little vegetation, these microbial processes are crucial to the carbon balance here and very important. Another unique aspect is that there are high amounts of iron. And as we saw on the last slide, this is an alternate electron acceptor for anaerobic respiration. So in these, we're going to have competition between the bacteria that want to breathe with iron and the bacteria that want to produce methane. And if we have iron reduction, we're going to have CO2 emission. That's a byproduct of this iron reduction, as opposed to methane produced by these archaea. And so that's a big question. The overarching goal of our study is what controls this balance. So the overarching question is, what's the role of iron reduction as a dominant respiratory process in these Arctic peat soils? And now we'll move on to talk a little about the technology that we're using. And so what we want to know is, how do we study this? So how can we tell what's going on in the soil up there, specifically on a microbe level? And one of the things that we use that is a major focus of the lab that I work in here is called the microbial electrochemical system. And what we do here is that we link microbial metabolism to electronic circuitry. So you can see that we have microbes, we have an electrochemical system, and we put them together to get a microbial electrochemical system. And kind of what do these systems do? Well, the first aspect to be discovered and widely investigated was bioenergy. And so basically we can get bacteria to produce electricity, to produce current and power by breathing in a microbial electrochemical system. And we can also use them for biosensing, which is what we're using them for. And that's a picture of some of our sensors installed in the tundra. And finally, we can talk about biocomputing. And what we can do here is we can actually get digital output from a environmental signal. And this has a lot of interesting applications that I won't go into now because I could talk about them for a long time. And so if we want to know more about how this works, what we see here on the top is we have a bacteria in green, and what it's going to do is it's going to take in some substrate. So in this case, this would be the carbon that's in the soil, and it's going to use that for energy, and it's going to produce some byproducts. And when it's done using this for energy, it's going to have an electron that needs to drop off. And in aerobic respiration, this would go to oxygen. And in anaerobic respiration, it can go to one of these alternate electron acceptors, in this case, iron. So it will give this electron to iron 3 in the environment and reduce it to iron 2. And what we can do is we can actually put a physical piece of graphite, so just like you'd find in a pencil, into the ground. And if we control it, and we can make the bacteria think that this is iron. And so that's what we have on the bottom here. So if we replace, if we put the biosensor probe into the ground and we control it with an electrical controller, we make the bacteria think that it's iron. So they will actually breathe with this piece of carbon that we put in the ground. And we can then measure the amount of electrons coming in, and we can look at that change over time. And that's what we're doing. So we have some type of quantitative measure of how many bacteria are breathing with iron in the environment. So the first major step of my thesis was to build these electrical controllers. They exist and are commercially available for use in the... I just saw a question from Julia. Okay, so how do we make the bacteria think that it's iron? Well, so basically what we do is we use the electrical controller to poise this piece of carbon in the soil at the same electric potential of iron. So if you were to look at a tower, a redox tower of chemical potentials for iron 3, we would set the electrical controller to make this piece of carbon at the same potential. Does that make sense? Okay, cool. I think I lost some I can't see slides anymore here.
Okay. So just tell us which one you want to go to for a moment. And
okay, I think I'm on the electrical controller slide.
Okay, can you see that now again or no?
No, I cannot.
Oh, weird. Okay, well, you have your presentation, I'm sure, around, but I sent you that PDF, so, I mean, it's just exactly the same as you set it up. We can kind of click through these for you if you'd like.
Okay.
Or you can iterate them and come back. Yeah, and I'm going to, you know what? Let's see, why are you not a moderator? There you are, you're still there. I'm going to knock you off being a moderator and bring you back on. We'll see what happens.
Okay.
Does that help at all?
Nope, but I can keep going here. It's not a big deal.
Okay.
So basically what I wanted to show you with this picture or this slide is that it took me a little bit of time to develop this electrical controller because it's they're basically available commercially for us to buy, and we have them in a lab, but they're very expensive and they're very fragile. And we couldn't bring that out to the Arctic and put it in the middle of a wetland. So I've basically stripped it down and built it back up from the ground again. And I could tell you about the electronics if you're interested, but basically what this slide was going to tell is that this took a long time. So we went through prototyping, revisions, testing in the lab, changes to the prototypes, testing them in the field.
There it is. Now.
Okay. And I have the presentation up separately, so we're good. So, and then finally, we went into production, and what we did was we produced basically 27 of these biosensors that we could put into the ground.
Wow.
And then we went out and we put them in the ground. So, on the top left is the actual sensors that go in the ground, and you can see that the black pieces coming out of the bottom are the actual carbon and the graphite materials that the bacteria grow on and breathe with. And then there are a couple pictures of these in the soils, and there are also some other probes around them where we're measuring other things. And finally, on the bottom right, we can see is we have an overview of our one site. So we've got some power. It's powered by a solar panel, which is great because we can basically put these wherever we want. We don't need to have access to infrastructure. For power lines, we can go out, and most of our sites are located a few miles from any available power. And so go to the results. I think I can still change the slides on here. I just can't. Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know if you could.
So the results.
Great, I'll be with you.
Okay. So, like I said, we've been up there 3 years, and we've been developing this technology. So these are results from last year, which is the first year that we had these biosensors functional and working and out in the environment. And on the left, what we're looking at is a measure of current versus time between July, basically for the entire month of July. And in the black line is a shallow depth, so that's at about 7 centimeters below surface. The darker gray is a medium depth, it's about 10 centimeters below surface, and the light gray is deep, which is about 14 centimeters below the surface. And this is about as thawed as things get up there over the summer. Somewhere between 15 and 18 centimeters is normally maximum thaw depth that you see right now. And so what we want to, the kind of results that we can take out of this year is that We have these daily cycles in activity. And we can see this in the shallow depth for the entire time and in the medium and deep depths for the second half of July. Now, one thing that's interesting here is that you might normally think, well, bacteria are on day-night, light-dark cycles, but things are light for 24 hours out there during this time. So these are actually temperature-driven fluctuations. Even though there are 24 hours of sunlight, the temperature still fluctuates based on the movement of the sun around the sky. And the second thing that we want to look at here is the fact that these daily cycles, which are a result of these bacteria responding to soil changes in soil temperature, they're occurring in the shallow depth for the entire month of July. But if we look at the medium and deep depths, for the first half, we don't see these daily cycles. There's basically existing at a background level. And then we get to about July 15th through the 21st, and all of a sudden we see that the medium depth jumps up, starts experiencing these cycles, and is basically the same magnitude as this shallow depth. And the deep depth is following this behind. It doesn't quite reach the same magnitude, but we do see these daily cycles start to evolve. And this is interesting because what we're seeing is basically these bacteria that were fairly inactive in lower soil levels are becoming awakened as soil temperature increases. And on the right, what I've done here is I've taken the medium depth, so the middle gray one from the previous plot, and I've looked at it against the soil temperature at that depth, which is the dotted line. And what we can see is that basically from July 1st to July 15th or 15th to 18th, the soil temperature is about on average 3 to 3.5 degrees Celsius. And then after this, from July 18th or 19th onward, the average soil temperature is about 5 to 5.5 degrees Celsius. So we see this jump of about 2 degrees in a period of a week in the middle of July. And this is what's driving the change in bacterial activity. So all of a sudden, these bacteria are becoming awakened. And this is particularly frightening because you think that, well, things are going to keep thawing a little bit deeper each year. So this is going to kind of continue to move down into the soil. So if we look at the kind of what's next, basically what we've done is, and earlier also, yeah. That's right, Sarah. So the major concerns are, one, things are going to be thawing deeper. So if you think of the entire surface area of that tundra that I showed you, and you think about how many bacteria are going to be active if we're thawing 1 centimeter deeper into the soil each year, or something like that, or how many bacteria are going to be active if in 5 years there's 10 centimeters more. And also, they're going to be thawing earlier, and they're going to be awakened for longer over the summer. So there's a lot of factors going on. So the next step, I'll tell you a little bit about our field season plans for this year. And what we really want to focus in on now is what we can detect these iron processes by bacteria going on. We want to know what happens to the methane emissions when we stimulate these iron. And also, what are the major factors controlling microbial dominance? So we may find that there are some environmental factors that are controlling whether the iron reduction or methanogenesis are dominant. And finally, we want to know, do current climate models accurately predict methane emissions from this site? And one thing that we found is that there seemed to be a lack of data sets for high latitude soils that people have to test these emission models with. So there are a lot of data sets from mid and tropical latitudes, and the models are very good at predicting these, but we're not quite sure how well they're going to perform for these high latitudes, because there just isn't that much data to be able to compare against. Let me look at the question. Are the density of the microbes changing over depth? We're not sure yet, and that's actually something we're working on now, is looking at the actual bacteria that exist in these different layers of soils. So we're going to be sequencing the DNA from the bacteria in these soils, and we'll be able to tell what bacteria are there and how they're changing over time and with different environmental factors. So conclusions. I hope I've convinced you that methane is a major player in the climate change equation. Okay, am I talking about archaea or regular bacteria for that we're sequencing? We're going to be looking at both. I don't know if that's what the question was. Okay.
Yeah, okay. Julia, if you want to ask your question, you know, you could kind of raise your hand if you want to use the talk.
Okay. Well, I'll keep going, and whenever you want to ask me, let me know. So I hope I've convinced you that methane is kind of a major factor in this climate change equation, especially in the Arctic, and that Arctic soils are an important carbon reservoir, and we're not really sure how climate change will affect the carbon balance. And this is particularly important here because these are the areas that are experiencing the most pronounced climate change thus far. Microbes are really a crucial component in the carbon cycle, and even at lower latitudes as well, but especially at these higher latitudes where we don't have as many plants, we have no trees, we basically have small grasses, and that's it. And then finally, one thing is additionally the concern is that there's a large range of methane emissions predicted in current models. And like I mentioned, one of the reasons for this is we don't have that much data from high latitude sites. And so one thing we're trying to do is fill the gap there and improve these models so that we can understand what might happen in different scenarios. And with that, I will acknowledge the people who helped me. So the people in our lab, the ancient lab here at Cornell, are Miriam Rosenbaum and Alex Lee. They were responsible for kind of helping the design of this biosensor. And Devin Down and Michaela Taravist are the other graduate students here working on these microbial electrochemical systems. The Barrow field team includes some members from San Diego State and Stanford who we collaborate with in this effort, and then our Polar Trek teacher from last year, Jim Miller from Cleveland Heights High School. We have the logistic providers, BASC, CH2M, Polar Hill, and filing the funding from NSF and Polar Trek.
Nice.
All right.
So, thank you.
With that, I'll answer any questions, and you can see my shameless self-promotion there. So, our 2012 field season, including our Polar Check teacher, Christina Solis, who's from LA Academy, and then also other members of the Ancient Lab have a high school curriculum available for building a type of microbial electrochemical system called the microbial fuel cell, and you can actually set this up in the lab, and you can power an LED with bacteria. So if you want to take a look at that, it's available online, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about it or anything else.
Yeah, Janet had a question of, are most models from the equator regions? And then I kind of had a question too, where else in the high Arctic are they doing these studies? And when I looked for resources for our class, I found a lot of things for bathymetry or under the oceans. Does that count? Does that help you, Elliot?
Well, I'm actually trying to pull out one of the lists here that tell me where the other Arctic sites are. In regards to the climate models, they're general climate models, but the, basically the way they do this is they take what data they have and they build a model to basically fit the data that they have, and then what they can do is you'll use a portion of your data to build the model, and then you'll use the rest of your data to test the model. So based on whatever amount of data you have, you take a small portion of it and you build your model to fit that, and then you go back with the model that you get out of it and you test how accurate it is for these other sites. I will try to find this table of locations. So for example, in one they do have a lot, they have a lot from the mid-latitudes, so Brazil, Venezuela, Panama, New Hampshire, Michigan, China, and basically most of the high latitude data sets are from Sweden and that Finland and that area. There are also some from Siberia and Canada and a few from Alaska, but that's the one where we're limited is these Arctic high latitude data sets.
Thanks. Okay, Julia, you want to ask your question? So go ahead.
Getting back to that other one, I was trying to figure out what I was asking. You are measuring you're mimicking the iron in the soil by using the graphite, and it's the methanogenic bacteria, which is the archaea, their activity that you're measuring, or do other anaerobic bacteria create methane, correct? Or am I wrong in that first question?
Okay, so I think I can answer this one, and then Noah's question kind of go together. So the archaea are the ones that produce methane. And there on the other side, there are bacteria that can alternatively breathe with iron. And so they're not competing. What they do different processes, but they're competing for nutrients and food, basically. So the carbon and the other limiting nutrients to growth, they're competing for these. And so basically, one will dominate if it has more favorable growth conditions. And so it's these iron bacteria that we're measuring. And the way we measure the activity of the methanogens, the archaea, is to measure the methane emissions that are coming out of the soil right above where we have our graphite. So what we can see is if we put these pieces of graphite in and we're making the growth conditions more favorable to the iron bacteria, we would expect that there's less methane emissions coming out. And you can let me know if that helps. I'll try to answer Noah's question too. So have you tried to alter the balance of CO2 versus methane produced by adding iron to the system? Yeah, so we have done some background studies with that in the past, and basically that's what we're going to be doing this year with the sensors, is we're basically adding iron. For all intents and purposes, we're adding iron. But one of the reasons we want to use this is because not to suggest geoengineering, but so one of the reasons we want to use the biosensor instead of adding iron is because in addition to being one of the electron acceptors, iron is also typically one of the nutrients that limits bacterial growth in general. So there's lots of carbon, they need carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, iron, and other nutrients, and iron is one of the ones that typically limits how much growth you can have. And so if we add iron, we've done that, and we see increased methane, usually. But then we still are questioning. We're questioning whether is that because they're iron reducing. What's happening? Are iron reducing bacteria becoming more prevalent, or are we just growing more bacteria and methanogenic archaea because we've added extra nutrients to the system? So that's one of the main reasons that we want to use this biosensor, is because we can make the iron available for the iron-reducing bacteria without stimulating growth overall by providing more iron as a nutrient.
Okay, great. So anybody else have questions that you want to ask live? Okay, go ahead, Melissa.
Hi, Elliot. This is Melissa. I'm a Polar Trek teacher, and I'll be up at Tulik this summer. And I just had a question in regards to talking to my students about methane-producing. I always have said methane-producing bacteria, and I know that they are in the group Archaea. Is it incorrect, or should I be calling them Archaea instead of bacteria? That's my main question.
Yeah, so that's a good question. So in the past, 15 to 20 years, we've basically changed the way we do classify these organisms, and maybe we can go back to I forget which slide it's on because I still can't see them. But the one with that phylogenetic tree, I have to look it up on my other computer where I have the things open. So it's methane. Is that this one? I think so. We've changed the way that we build these trees of life. And that was basically catalyzed by the availability of sequencing. So now that we can sequence DNA, what we can do is we build these phylogenetic trees based on the similarity of the DNA in these organisms. And so kind of that older, at least what I learned in school was the five kingdom approach of the animals and fungus and everything, and we've changed that to be based on this DNA. So I guess I don't know if it's bad to say bacteria. I think if we want to include talking about both bacteria and archaea, I would say you could say microorganisms. Instead of bacteria. So hopefully that helps.
Okay.
Looks like, let's see. Julia's got another question. Did you want
to? Yeah, I just saw that for some reason my chat stopped auto-scrolling. So are we combining
you're having some issues.
Combining any of these results of the changes in aerobic respiration and CO2 production in the air? Yeah, so one thing we also want to see is we are measuring dissolved oxygen concentrations, and basically, specifically in these lakes and lake basins, there's not a lot of aerobic respiration simply because it gets anaerobic so fast, and the reason for that is, I guess we can go to this next slide. That's not the one I want. I'll have to go up on the slide. So the water table is typically at or above the ground surface. And if you have that, what you'll have is basically you'll be totally anaerobic in the soil. So there are very small areas where there is some aerobic activity. And one thing that we'll hopefully be able to see is differences when we do look at the microbial communities, so what bacteria are living there, we may be able to distinguish these aerobic areas based on their microbial communities.
Okay, Melissa, go ahead, ask a question.
Yes, you mentioned that, and I don't know if this was an example you were giving or if there's actual data, but that the thaw depth of 1 centimeter per year, is that something that we've been seeing? I'm curious because I'm going to be looking at thaw depth when I'm up there, so I just wanted to hear what you knew about that. I know it's not quite directly in your project, but.
Yeah, so I didn't mean to be misleading, but that 1 centimeter year was just a number I made up to kind of maybe say, you know, if we think about 200 miles by about 500 or 600 miles, there's a fairly large surface area. And then if right now only the top 15 centimeters are active, if you increase that even by 1 centimeter, that's, you know, that whole surface area is a large volume of soil where there's going to be more bacteria. So it was just the number I made up. But I will definitely follow your expedition and see what thaw depth means you have. It's one of the things we measure when we are up there, but I don't know the numbers off the top of my head.
Okay. Anybody else have questions? Mulling it over. All right, well, it's almost time for us to wrap up here. Oh, people are typing here, but in case you didn't get a chance or you to ask a question or you have more things you want to ask Elliot, we do have his email address. I'm sure he'd be happy to respond to things. And also, he does have access, if you're in the online class, he does have access to that discussion board as well. So, anybody? Okay.
Yeah, Elliot, thank you so much. That was really great, and everybody's sending you some good thanks there.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, well, thanks.
Well,
anyone.
Elliot, thank you for taking that.
Oh, I was just going to say if anyone has questions, okay, you can feel free to post on that message board or email me or anything like that.
All right, yeah, and thank you for taking the time, Elliot, to be with us and for everybody that joined us. And we will stay online here for a little bit longer. Elliot, if you have a moment, we'd like to talk to you about some of your technical issues in the meantime.